This is FinTech Takes, the podcast keeping you in the loop on all the latest FinTech trends, news, and ideas. I'm Alex Johnson, creator of the FinTech Takes newsletter, your host and self-confessed FinTech nerd. Let's go. Hello, and welcome back to Bank Nerd Corner, your favorite podcast where we have way too long and way too hot takes on all of the latest niche banking topics. My name is Alex Johnson, and I am joined, as always, by the queen of bank nerds herself, the banking and fintech editor at Bank Director, Kia Hazlett. Kia, hello.
Hey, Alex, how are you?
I am doing well. Happy belated birthday, by the way. I don't think
Thank
I got
you.
A chance to say that, but I hope everything was great and you got a chance to celebrate.
I did. It was Easter. My birthday sometimes falls on Easter, and I did not have soccer games. And coincidentally, all my friends were free to get dinner. And so I'm also very excited that I think that I'm older than I look. And so every time I have a birthday, that delta grows. So this is a very exciting time to be looking a lot younger than I actually am.
Nice. That's very good. Ever since I had kids, my age is showing up on my face in a way that I'm not having as much fun with, but I'm glad for you. I'm very happy for you.
Have you and your wife discussed a skincare routine and thought about adding retinol?
So we don't have time to get into that, but I will say that my wife has vastly more knowledge and passion around all things skincare than I do. So when it gets really bad, I will turn to her, and I'm sure she'll have a whole bevy of solutions just waiting for me. We won't go into that though, Kia, because unlike our normal podcast where you and I just get distracted about a huge number of topics, we're going to try to stay focused because this is the first Bank Nerd Corner where we are honored to have a guest joining us. Would you mind introducing him?
Help attract more borrowers and build a more resistant loan portfolio. Payment Guard Insurance from TrueStage is a first-of-its-kind insurance solution designed for digital lenders to do just that. Visit www.truestage.com/payment-guard to learn more and talk with a member of the TrueStage team.
Yeah, we invited someone who is really going to up the ante on the bank nerds and hopefully put us to shame. So joining us today is Stephen Kelly, the Associate Director of Research at the Yale Program on Financial Stability. Hi, Stephen.
Hey, great to be here, guys.
Thank you for joining us, and thank you for humoring our discussion on skincare. We probably will diverge onto a couple other topics, as you might know, listening to the podcast, but we are going to try to stay focused. Unlike our typical outline where we will sort of bounce through a bunch of different stories, we're going to try to steer the conversation into a direction to take advantage of Stephen's expertise in all things financial stability and just the sort of macro questions around the financial industry overall. Plenty of topics that I think Kia and I are hoping to get a little smarter on and to pick your brain on. So we're going to start off with, Kia, I think one that I know we've talked about this on the podcast before. This is like
several times
one of your passion projects. So go.
Yeah. So I wanted to talk about this because Q1 24 bank earnings are coming out. They start April 12th. And if you'll recall, both last year at this time and then also last quarter, we have had some questions around the relationship between stock prices and bank financial health and bank solvency. And, you know, on the outside, you know, I have my own thoughts about what I think is happening and the correlation and causation, but I have always argued that we don't have great data about this. And obviously this is really important, right? We saw, I think for the first time, really like a pretty concerning run following some stock sell-off. And I think there's a big inclination to say that there's maybe a one-to-one relationship, 100% correlation there. But Stephen, you have written about this topic and you have written and you tie it all the way back to like solvency, right? So not just, you know, the question for me, which is bank stock prices and deposits, but then kind of all the way to the end with a failure. So can you like share with me or with us, you know, where your research has gone into and then kind of what your impressions were maybe last year with SVB or last quarter with New York Community?
Sure. So I think you're generally right, Kia, that there tends to be too much connection made in the media between stock prices and deposit runs at banks. And, you know, like you can look at SVB and it's like, well, the stock went down 5 seconds before a deposit run started. So therefore, you know, we have causality there. And generally, you know, I would say you're right that, you know, we can sort of calm down about bank stock prices to some degree. Like, God forbid a bank loses money. Like, you know, they're set up to do that to some degree. What becomes more worrisome is when it really starts sinking through several floors. So
okay.
You know, And I think this was sort of the impetus for our whole conversation today, which was really the NYCB story and how much the stock price dipped. And we saw this with Credit Suisse too. Like when you talk about a stock trading at $3, you have to start worrying, because you can think about the market value, the market equity value of a bank as sort of, you know, the theoretical, what the market has viewed as how much capital is ahead of its debt, how much capital is there to insulate these banks against losses. And so when a stock goes from $100 to $90, like, you're not that worried. Mm-hmm. That's what equity holders are there for. That's why bank regulators talk about equity the way they do. Like, it's just there to absorb losses and keep depositors, you know, calm and happy. When it hits $3, you're like, okay, this is basically just an option on the bank that it might make money. Like, this is an insolvent bank, which means the debt, you know, is maybe not looking so good. And okay, maybe it's not investment grade anymore. And if it's not investment grade and I'm a depositor, I have all these competitors I can take my bank, I can take my money to. So it works a little differently in the case of like March 2023 versus March 2024. In that there's been, it's always March, you know,
it's a bad month, COVID.
It's always,
how
it's
dare
always
you? March. This is my birthday month.
Yeah, I know, right? So the difference is we're 1 year into the same bank crisis at that point. So there's been a lot more analysis done, because I mean, the way these runs unfold, right, is like the second third, you're in an acute crisis and you have something that's offering you par that you've done no analysis on. I'm talking about deposits now, or any really senior bank debt. You just take it and move it somewhere else and you do the analysis later. And so NYCB had the advantage of, okay, we've done a year of analysis. We sort of know where these banks sit. But there's still all these costs that come with the stock price going down. So the stock price thing was kind of a surprise, right? The OCC comes in, says you got to hold all this liquidity, you got to cut your dividend. Nobody really knew this was going to happen. So the stock price goes down. And then what else happens? Well, the rating agencies are all over it. They're issuing reports. And that starts to threaten the debt. And
there's a material weakness.
Right. There's more supervisors in the door. NYCB 6x's its loss because they do a big goodwill write down. And why do they, how do they validate the goodwill write down? They say, well, based on our market valuation, we need to write down all this goodwill. So there's all these sort of things. And it's worse. The bigger the bank, you know, they have trading relationships where they may have to post more collateral when a stock price goes down or when they get downgraded. So all these sort of things start to happen. And at the risk of getting us too far away, I mean, this is also part of the story about like, how do we discipline banks, you know, and how do we keep them, you know, how do we keep like healthy banks in business and let unhealthy banks go out of business? Like, this was part of the discussion around uninsured deposits in 2023. Like, oh, we need uninsured depositors to discipline banks, and the threat of run is what matters. But a lot happens with stock price too. I mean, as soon as the stock price, you know, can go through a certain floor, a lot of bad things start happening, and we sort of weed out bad banks that way.
Yeah. So it sounds like the stock price is maybe the first domino, and sometimes the domino doesn't tip fully over, but then below like maybe a certain price threshold, the capital is like, it's just not, they're not going to be able to raise capital. And so you, it kind of just takes one of those options off the table. And then, you know, there's also, and I think one of the things I've had to learn is that this is just such a public signal, and people use it because we don't have better data. And so, you know, these situations where we have these big stock sell-offs and the bank has to come out and say, like, our deposits are stable. And it's almost like a catch-22 where it's like, hey, if we keep talking about it, though, like, they might start pulling deposits. Like,
right.
We all got to be really quiet and not wake the deposit so they don't leave.
Just to add one thing to that, and I know you've talked a little bit about this on Twitter and elsewhere, but I am curious about, like, how the relationship between stock price and like just depositor awareness in a broad sense has changed over time. Cause that seems to be like the other variable here. And I wasn't investing in stocks for banks in the 90s. So I don't have the historical context to appreciate like what it used to be like versus what it's like today, but that would seem to be the other element to that. Right.
Yeah. That's a big question. And Kia talked about this a little bit too, which was like, we don't really know how much NYCB benefited because depositors think they bank with Flagstar. And it
or
was
like
Queen NYCB.
County Savings Bank. Yeah.
Right. It was NYCB in the head. So there's like maybe a lesson there. Like if you want to have a big bank conglomerate, just make the holding company name something different. But it's a big question. I mean, the other thing this gets into, though, is like the question of depositor awareness is sort of less relevant in a world of deposit insurance, right? Because you're talking about, you know, people with more than $250,000 in liquidity, you know, we're talking about a sort of a financially astute, this is firms, this is businesses, this is pension funds, right? Corporate treasurers. So the whole like depositor awareness, you know, it's real because as soon as something's in the Wall Street Journal, you can sort of see that run start to take place. So that's a real question for sure.
So how much do stock prices matter for bank health or what we would think of bank health? And I'm asking because I'm beefing with a lot of journalists who were writing at the time in March that, or, you know, before the capital raise announcement that basically the OCC could go in and close New York Community this weekend or next weekend. And I just felt like that was completely irresponsible to say that the stock sell-off and a declaration of material weaknesses, while not great, did not necessitate like a prompt corrective action failure. And that also marketing a bank to that is about to be closed normally takes weeks, not days. And, you know, especially if we don't have the liquidity runoff. So is the answer like it mostly doesn't, but sometimes it does?
Yeah, it matters in a crisis. I mean, it matters tremendously in a crisis. And you know, the ethics of journalism around some of this stuff is really hard for sure. Like I won't even get into that. I mean, it's very complicated, but it definitely matters in a crisis. And we saw part of the success too in 2009 of the stress test. The initial stress test was there was, you know, and just to remind listeners, the way this was going to work was there was going to be a stress test and determine how much capital the big banks still needed to raise. They then had to go out and raise it. And if they didn't raise it, they got government money, you know, which was in theory more punitive. But the natural inclination is like, we should punish the banks, right? They caused this problem, but that perpetuates a crisis. So part of the story there was they put a floor, a known floor on the stock prices of at what price the government would buy in at.
Oh, interesting.
So that sets a floor and really helps stabilize the system of like, Okay, investors know that they're not going to get too diluted. They know where the floor is. They know that the price isn't going to go below or the government's going to be there. And that was really important in helping that work. So there really is a floor in a crisis. But yeah, I mean, in normal course, like if Deutsche Bank goes, again, if it goes from $200 to $150, like whatever, it doesn't matter. But when you're talking about a crisis, really every penny counts and those headlines matter.
And then my final question about this, as we think about Q2 and, you know, which dominoes are going to fall at what banks is, you know, tied up in all of this is a concern about bank solvency. And I don't think we've really fully, and maybe in banking we have, but I think in fintech, there's a lot of like dumb takes about bank solvency. So, sorry, Alex.
No, that's fair.
But, you know, as long as interest rates remain high and banks still have, you know, these unrealized losses, you know, there's still talk about, you know, a bank is doomed if they have negative TCE or low TCE. And then their stock price falls. And, you know, I think we're all just kind of extrapolating from things we saw with SVB without fully understanding maybe some of the broader mechanics around bank solvency and health. So kind of where are you on this, you know, a year from what we saw with SVB? And also, you know, what are some of the misconceptions you see around bank solvency, especially like thinking about last quarter?
Yeah, I would say that the biggest misconception is that if a bank shows negative equity, it is non-viable. And that was part of the narrative that came out after SVB, which really ignores the fact that it operated with negative equity for 6 months.
Yeah.
9 months.
Yeah.
And frankly, there were dozens of banks in the same situation that we've never heard of.
There's still banks that have negative equity, right?
Right. I mean, Charles Schwab was in this situation. Bank of America was like almost in this situation, right? and there was never going to be a run on Bank of America. And so part of the story is like, you have to look at the business model, right? How long did Amazon operate before it turned to profit?
Right.
So it's not that investors were ignoring the negative equity. It was right there on the balance sheet for anyone to see. They were discounting it. Really, mark-to-market valuations aren't real if you can hold on to deposits, you know. So, and if you like the business model of the bank, right, if you can get equity, if you need it, right? I mean, Bank of America can raise equity in a second if it really needed it. There's no incentive to run on the bank or sell off this bank. So it really is a business model story. And what started at SVB was them coming out saying, look, you know, we think we have the loyalest depositors in the world, but they're just pulling their money because they need it. Like we're just, and that's causing us to have to sell these assets and realize all these losses. And, oh, and by the way, we tried to raise equity and we had some equity investors look at our business model and we couldn't get enough in the door.
Right.
So it's sort of all those things, which is not a story that applies to every bank worried about negative TCE, right?
Yeah.
Schwab is the most popular brokerage in America. Like Bank of America could get money from Warren Buffett in 2 seconds. So there's sort of all these things. And it really is a business model story combined, you know, no doubt combined with that vulnerability that's built into the negative TCE and the unrealized losses. But also some of that's going away. Like, yes, rates are staying high, but stuff matures. And as stuff matures and gets reinvested, those unrealized losses go away. And we just have really profitable banks making high interest rates.
I was just going to say, I mean, just to put a fine point on that, it was by far the misconception that drove me the craziest after SVB was, and Kia, we'd ranted about this multiple times on the podcast, but these unrealized losses, like, they're not real. They're not real. I kept like screaming that into the void. But it does, I think the
that's adjective.
Unrealized, like it's not like they're not bad assets. Like, what are we talking about? But it was a really interesting, I think it is a really interesting point about the business model thing, because I think that was the thing for a lot of folks when they started looking at all of these banks that were sort of at one level, kind of similar as like a category, like these are all roughly this size from an asset perspective. This is all roughly the type of business lines they're in. But then you sort of drill in at a more granular level, and you appreciate that like SVB's business model was just very different than almost any other bank. And so like the distinction between the way that we categorize banks at kind of a high level, or that they sort of get reported up through all of the public reporting that they're required to do, that is very different than the business models that they sell to equity investors. And like when those two things kind of collide into each other, that seemed like where a lot of the drama came from.
Right. And you talk about what name is in the headlines. Like, if your name is Silicon Valley Bank and there is a recession in the tech industry,
right?
Like, it's only a matter of time. You can't be a niche bank and have the attention of the market, right? I mean, you can't be NYCB that gets associated with being like a New York commercial real estate bank, because right. Then as soon as New York commercial real estate's in the headlines, right, everyone's going after NYCB. You can't be Silicon Valley
Bank.
It
all comes back down to bank names in the
end. I was just going to say that, Kia. Yeah, like this is an argument for everyone just being called First American, whatever, blah, 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 like yeah. The most generic name possible.
Right.
First Amalgamated, yeah. And before
yeah,
I pass
Amalgamated,
it,
that's actually a good point, because Amalgamated yeah. has negative TCE and they've been doing fine.
Don't say anything. Don't draw attention
yeah.
to it.
No one knows what they do. It's fine. Yeah.
Yeah,
I'll
right.
pass this over to Alex, but I do want to throw him under the bus and say that Alex is a little pro mark to market. He's pro what's the other type of accounting that's not financial accounting? Fair value accounting. And so I'm putting him on blast. Maybe we'll have to talk about this later.
It's
a truly nerdy conversation about the merits of both accounting methods. But anyway, Alex, I'll turn it over to you.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, we won't go into a whole accounting thing, or we'll be here for the next 3 hours. But there is sort of a tie into our next story. So another one we wanted to ask you about, Stephen, is tokenization. And I know you've written about this and have looked at this pretty closely. But I will admit, one of the things I'm always surprised by is when I sort of review all of the public commentary, speeches, comments, things that regulators say publicly. A lot of it is stuff that I sort of anticipate or that I see coming. And then occasionally there'll be something where I'm like, whoa, didn't see that coming, or didn't see this being sort of a topic. And tokenization is one that has been popping up a lot from a regulatory perspective, particularly over the last, I don't know, year and a half, 2 years. Sort of as we went through kind of a winter on the crypto side, you started to see folks like FDIC Vice Chairman Travis Hill or Acting Comptroller Michael Hsu at the OCC talk about tokenization. And when they talk about it, I guess a couple things that strike me as interesting that I'd love for you to kind of respond to. One is that the way they're defining tokenization is very much in a non like crypto context. So just to be like super clear, when they talk about tokenization, this is the idea of being able to apply distributed ledger or blockchain technology to speed up or make more efficient complex financial transactions in areas around commercial bank deposits, government and corporate bonds, money market funds, commodities, real estate, sort of like the sort of bespoke, very highly manual settlement and accounting sort of processes that happen around those complex financial instruments. They look at a technology like tokenization, again, divorced from all of the speculation and kind of decentralized libertarian craziness that you see in crypto. They look at sort of the underlying technology, and I guess it's interesting to me that they seem sort of cautiously optimistic about the technology despite crypto melting to the ground and having all these problems. They look at it and they kind of seem to see, from my perspective, I mean, no regulator is going to be super, super optimistic about technology, but they see the potential for this technology to add value to some of those transactions and to make them more efficient. So, I mean, I guess my first question, Stephen, is, am I reading those comments right? Like, what is the sort of general takeaway from bank regulators when they look at tokenization as a technology?
So I think your read is correct. And sort of the long game here has always looked like, you know, big banks win in the end type of thing with all this crypto and tokenization.
Right.
You know, the technology has been moving sort of more quietly at the banks, but it's there. And, you know, I think the ideal future here where, you know, where everything is painted in chrome is the following. We have not only financial assets and bank deposits existing on a blockchain, but you can put physical assets on the blockchain too. So when I sell you something, Alex, we can do the exchange with our phone and the money is immediately in my account and the legal ownership transfers immediately to you.
Yep.
That is sort of the big dream with tokenization and the big innovation that can come with it. And you can imagine how this simplifies things like supply chains. You basically take away so much float cost from payments taking forever and documents moving forever that need to be signed. The fact that this information can move back and forth and you can transfer physical goods on the same rails, you know, what's called atomic settlement, where both legs have to move at once or the transaction doesn't happen. So the money moves one way and ownership moves the other way and it's settled atomically. It's settled, you know, simultaneously. So that's sort of the future painted in chrome.
No, that makes sense. And I'm glad you painted sort of a vision of that. I remember this was a couple of years ago, but I saw sort of a proof of concept product demo and it was using distributed ledger technology. I think it was actually using NFTs, which is kind of hilarious. But basically it was using a combination of NFTs running on a public blockchain in combination with a trust, a legal trust that would take ownership over real estate deeds. And basically they sort of constructed this example to show how they could speed up the settlement process for a real estate transaction by just instantly being able to transfer over the title and deed without all of the paperwork and filing things manually at county clerk's offices and all the sort of nonsense that we go through today. And it was a really interesting illustration. Now, obviously, there are lots of, like, particularly when you talk about physical assets living on a ledger, there are lots of sort of last mile legal considerations that have to go through with that. Because if my house is being repossessed because, you know, I don't have the deed, like, who do you go find that information out for? And are the cops willing to come to my house and kick me out of it in order to do that? So it feels like there's a lot of sort of last mile problems to be solved. But to your point, you can look at this technology and go, wow, that could strip a lot of costs out of the system. The flip side to it, and obviously regulators are going to always have this in mind as well, is what are the risks from a financial stability perspective or otherwise to speeding all of this up? And I was looking at some of the comments that regulators have made, and Vice Chairman Hill gave this example that I thought was interesting. Programmability may make it easier for customers to automatically remove funds following negative news about a bank, which could exacerbate runs. And what he's talking about there is this idea that, to your point, if something is tokenized, then you can actually make that token programmable in the sense that without a human being having to push a button, it can be monitoring systems or information. And when those pieces of information meet certain thresholds, it can just automatically trigger a transaction, which is efficient. But efficiency going towards a crisis isn't always a good thing. So, like, what's your take on the sort of downside or the risks to tokenization from a financial stability perspective?
Yeah. So the programmability and the smart contracts are exactly these written rules, you know, how you write these rules that automatically execute. There are a couple financial stability concerns there. But one step ahead of that even is just the financial stability benefit from what a tokenized deposit represents, which is you can take everything you like about stablecoins, which is you have a dollar representation on the blockchain and you get rid of the intermediary. So all the stablecoin intermediaries are doing is standing between me and a bank, right? So we saw this with SVB, right? Circle had $3.3 billion in SVB. It's the second biggest stablecoin.
Yep.
You know, this was USDC. They had $3.3 billion in SVB, right? That is a financial stability risk versus if all of Circle's customers had some uninsured deposits in SVB, right? So getting rid of the intermediary by tokenizing the deposit directly is helpful. And getting rid of this need for them to then hold assets and hold safe assets, you know, let a bank make risky loans and do what a bank does and be insured and all these things. So that's step one. That's good. Smart contracts are sort of a double-edged sword because I'm less worried about Director Hill's comments that people are going to write smart contracts into their deposit accounts that say, like, if there's bad news about my bank, like, I don't see it getting to that level.
Yeah.
And frankly, if you're a large corporate depositor, you can say, hey, look, if the stock price goes to 3, wire my money out.
Like, right.
You can sort of already do that.
Yeah.
So there's a couple things that happen in a crisis, particularly when the market is worried about a particular bank, which is one, you stop sending payments to them. You say, and we see this happen in crisis. Like if there's a, you know, if it's Bear Stearns or whatever in the headlines, you go, hey, let's slow down the wires to Bear Stearns.
Yeah.
They're going to fail. They owe us money, right? Let's slow down the wires. So you can't do that in a world of smart contracts. So that's good. If you're Bear Stearns and you're possibly going to fail or get a rescue and it's going to come down to the wire, what do? Well, you slow down the wires and you don't answer your phone
right.
And you ignore collateral calls. And that's sort of good.
Like, yeah, right.
We sort of want like AIG to break the law in the last few hours of its life when it
well,
might get to rescue, right?
Yeah, this is the old like stockbroker thing,
it's
right? Where like
time.
The yeah. stockbroker's job when there's a crisis is to not answer your call when you call them. Like that's their job.
Right.
But Stephen and Alex, to your point, like Alex, you asked a question that we already, this question has been answered in the stock market. There are circuit breakers, right? There are
right.
pauses that are built in automatically on news or on activity, and they kind of, they go whether or not, you know, we think this company's going to fail or righteously being sold off. And so I do think it's interesting to think about how this problem is addressed in other parts of the financial system, right? And maybe the answer is just don't pick up the phone call or, you know, don't look at the website or
yeah.
I don't know how you build in these circuit breakers into tokenized smart contracts.
It's an important thought, Kia, because, you know, something else we see is like rules with money market funds where when they fall below a certain threshold, they can introduce gates to their customers. Mm-hmm. And what we find is that that backfires. The
oh.
expectation that the gates are going to be there makes people run sooner and faster.
To get through the gate before,
right.
before
so,
it closes.
So that really is an important question. I just am really dubious that you can, you know, when you talk to sort of smart contract purists about like financial stability risks, they'll say, well, we'll build in kill switches so we can, you know, effectively circuit breakers. It's like, okay, so first of all, you told me that the perk here was decentralization. Who are you going to give a kill switch to? Jerome Powell? Like, you can't do that. And
yeah.
secondly, ironically, kill switches don't have enough decentralization. What we benefit from is we don't know, you know, right? We being the system, we being regulators, don't know where that crisis is at its most fragile, and we rely on them to not pick up the phone.
Mm-hmm.
And so you just can't distribute kill switches that way. And that's a financial stability risk. So you have this thing where like counterparties can't take as much. If you have a world of all smart contracts, your counterparties can't take advantage of you as much. They can't say, hey, you know what? We don't like that mark. Give us a little more collateral. You're testing your counterparty, right? You say, hey, Bear Stearns has been in the news. Well, I think you owe me a little more collateral. You're seeing if they can do it. So you can't do that because you can say, look, the smart contract is fed by this oracle and it says that the mark is at this and therefore we don't owe you any collateral. So that's good. But it impedes Bear Stearns' ability to say, hey, we don't owe you any collateral when they actually do owe some collateral.
Right, right. Which is a net benefit to the system at times. I mean, the other thing that you touched on there that I do think is really an interesting question with this is from a regulatory perspective, again, when they say tokenization, they mean like highly centralized tokenization. So this is like on the
right.
opposite end of the spectrum from crypto purists who think about a completely trustless system with nodes in a network where no one actually has to know each other or trust each other at all. The regulatory vision of this, obviously, for a number of reasons, is much more on the trusted end of it. But it does go to your point about like, what is the right level of decentralization for this stuff? Like when we talk about decentralization, do we mean, well, JP Morgan Chase has its own distributed ledger that they use and, you know,
which they do.
Yeah, right. Which they've been working on and like, and which other banks work on that ledger versus have their own and are the different ledgers interoperable with each other? And, you know, I
yeah.
think that there's, from an infrastructure standpoint, a really interesting question around to what degree should this infrastructure be owned and operated by private companies and sort of subject to the incentives that they would have versus, yeah, like, I don't know what regulatory requirements should exist around interoperability or who gets to put kill switches where. Like, that would seem like where a lot of
Alex
the arts to this
one,
is.
Alex just wants one, like, consortium and one set of rails and one ledger to rule them all, right? Like,
I don't believe in the free market, as Kia knows very well. No, I don't know. I mean, Stephen, what's your take on just, like, the degree of decentralization with this stuff?
Yeah, that's the biggest challenge. Where I mean, JP Morgan has a $4 trillion balance sheet. So for them to have an internal blockchain ledger is already helpful to all their customers because, like, you know, it may be the case that a port company and a shipping company are actually both JP Morgan clients.
Right.
Or maybe now they're incented to be. So you can sort of do the whole transaction. You can do that. There's this whole economy that exists on JP Morgan's balance sheet.
Right. Right.
But the idea is we want Citi coins to be interoperable with JPM coins. And that's going to be the hardest challenge. But, you know, regulators, I think they like this in theory, but they're behind on it. Like, there was so much hype around FedNow coming out this year. And like, that's not tokenized. There's no securities on FedNow. So for as much as like great as it is for some retail payments, if banks sign up, like it's still 10 steps behind where the private sector is on this. And so I don't know how that circle gets squared.
I also think it's interesting to think about why regulators are talking about tokenization, you know, instead of Jamie Dimon, and to think that like this is some active market structure that they're trying to maybe suss out in public. And we often, you know, I think in banking, you know, it feels like to me sometimes we just do an evolution of the thing we used to do, and there isn't, you know, some of these hard breaks. You know, I wasn't really there when the internet came around, so maybe that was a harder break than I'm, you know, giving it credit for. But for regulators to kind of insert themselves into this conversation and say, like, what is the role that we would play? What are the risks that we should be thinking about, rather than just having these total private market solutions and then trying to build the world, right? And versus like, and also like, tokenization just sounds like fancy accounting to me. I don't know if that's a totally cynical take, but it's like, how do we make people care about accounting and all the problems that come from like updating our account, you know, the dual accounts or whatever? Yeah. So
I think the ideal world is that nobody knows about tokenization, that it exists in the way that, you know, ACH exists now versus Fedwire, where nobody needs to know about that, really. You know, you need to know how fast your payments land, but aside from that, you don't really need to know about the infrastructure. And ideally, that's I think where we get with tokenization. It's the infrastructure behind the scene that some people know about, but nobody needs to know about.
I'm glad you did mention Fed now, because when we had Mark Gould from the Federal Reserve on my podcast last year, that was one of the things that we asked about and that he kind of talked about, was this idea that it's a net benefit when you speed all this stuff up, right? And not that there isn't like risk associated with that, and that risk needs to be managed. You need to build in circuit breakers or other mechanisms to manage that risk. But it's a net benefit when you add efficiency to the system. And I actually think we are seeing, with the slow rollout of FedNow and the slow adoption of it, a lot of the incumbent providers, whether they're banks or infrastructure providers, sort of slowing down the adoption of FedNow, because there actually is a lot of value accruing to them based on an older, less efficient system. So I do like generally when regulators kind of put their shoulder into it a bit and say, no, we're going to, you know, go to this next level, and the gains in efficiency are going to be worth kind of the headaches that it creates. Kia, should we do a quick lightning round of things before we let Stephen go?
Sure. I am going to try to keep this short, but if anyone knows the movie, that is oxymoronic or ironic. Stephen, you have talked about the Federal Home Loan Bank, the FHLB, and I too have talked about the FHLB. And I wanted to, you know, do like, I guess, a pretty quick primer about the role this institution plays in America's financial system. So, you know, for the fintech listeners who maybe aren't able to borrow from the FHLB, what is it and what role does it play in banking?
So there's this system that was founded about 100 years ago with 12 regional banks that is designed to provide liquidity to financial institutions and is sort of a public-private partnership. And if that sounds like the Fed to you, it should. This is the FHLBs. It is a worse version of the Fed.
Okay.
It gets in the way of the Fed. It has outlived much of its usefulness, at least in its current form. There are now only 11 FHLBs because one failed, or merged rather, in the financial crisis, FHLB Seattle. So this is another thing, is that there are 12. They don't line up exactly with Fed districts.
I know the Iowa one's just really, really big and goes all the way up to
FHLB
Washington.
Seattle moved into FHLB Des Moines. So that is that's one geography. But that just makes it all the more difficult for the Fed to talk to the FHLBs. But anyways, ostensibly what it does is it provides liquidity to members against housing assets. And it's designed to basically help, you know, make housing lending more liquid. It is a collective, it is a private institution. So its members are banks and insurance companies. And you pay in sort of a nominal amount of capital to be a member. and you receive dividends. But the way it works is when a bank wants a loan, it will post assets to the FHLB.
When it wants a loan from the FHLB. So it's from like the FHLB. Line of credit, right?
Yeah. So it has to post either real estate assets or government assets, which is a whole other problem that you can bring treasuries there. Real estate assets or government assets, the FHLBs collectively borrow. So they are a government-sponsored enterprise. They will tell you that they are not guaranteed by the U.S. government, which is true, but much like Fannie and Freddie, which had to be rescued, they sort of have an implicit, you know, an implicit government backing. And it's explicit in a lot of ways, too. They don't pay income taxes. They are able to sell assets to government money market funds, which otherwise can only, you know, hold treasury assets. So they basically can get seniorage by issuing very, very cheap debt and lending to banks. And so really what happens is we see this system used tremendously in a crisis, particularly ahead of the Fed, because it is, you know, less stigmatized, it's less public, it's often cheaper, but it's very problematic. They take limited amounts of collateral, you know, like I said, only real estate and government assets. They're not going to take a commercial industrial loan as collateral. So, you know, a bank can sort of run out of collateral. They have to issue debt to fund it. The Fed can hit a few keyboard keys and make money. If you go to the FHLBs too late in the day and it's too big of an amount you want, they have to issue debt and they can't do it till the next day. So there's sort of all these challenges that come with the FHLBs, but basically they're a massive rent collection.
Tell us how you really feel.
The CBO just came out with a report that said the government subsidies to the FHLB system are expected to be $7 billion this year. Last year, which was an immensely profitable year for the FHLBs.
Yeah, it was a good year for the FHLBs. It's like the only people who made money last year, apparently.
Because they made so many loans, right? They made a little over $6 billion. So they are not profitable without the government subsidy. And so anyways, the idea is like, okay, they support housing. This is sort of their benefit.
They ostensibly support housing, right? The word home is in the name. Yes.
Right. And, you know, the members have to have certain housing requirements to join. Like they have to have a certain percentage of their assets be housing when they join. They don't have to keep that certain percentage in housing assets. Like we'll see insurance companies use real estate assets to like fund mergers using the FHLBs. So it's so divorced from its goals, and it pays dividends to members based on how much they borrow, which actually reduces their effective borrowing costs.
I wish I got a dividend for how much money I borrow. What a great deal.
Right. That's because they're owned by their members in theory. You know, they have this sort of government blessing, but they're owned by their collective, owned by their members. And instead of paying dividends out to, you know, who does the most affordable housing, which is their other goal, they sort of have these two prongs, which is like to provide liquidity to members and support housing. And it's like, okay, the one read of that is like, oh, you're supposed to provide liquidity to support housing.
Yeah.
Or we're supposed to be the Fed and we're supposed to maybe support housing. They're legally required to give 10% of their profits to affordable home projects. They put out a report suggesting that they could raise that Congress raise that requirement. So now's kind of the time for reform. We'll see how much happens. Sandra Thompson, the head of the FHFA, which has oversight responsibility for the FHLBs, clearly cares about affordable housing and, you know, seems to not like the distraction that are these things. I mean, they issued $500 billion of debt the week of SVB's failure.
Yeah. So let's talk about that. So it's not for no reason we're bringing this up. But sometimes it's interesting because I think the role that the FHLB has played in several bank failures is maybe underappreciated. And so to go back to SVB, SVB basically maxes out the San Francisco FHLB, right? They can't keep borrowing. And so, you know, famously, Thursday night, they have to move their collateral that they had put at the FHLB, which could not raise capital in the market. They have to bring it to Bank of New York Mellon, who is their, like, I don't know, banker's bank, because SVB wasn't really connected to the discount window. And that's how they borrow on Thursday night from the discount window. And then they're closed Friday morning. And then, you know, famously Silvergate, you know, the famous mortgage bank Silvergate borrowed several times from the FHLB with what collateral, I have no idea, but they don't fail. They liquidate. They actually pay back the the FHLB. And then, you know, I don't know if how much this would cross your financial stability radar, but Heartland Tri-State was a small bank in Kansas that failed last year after the CEO anomalously borrowed $21 million from the FHLB, which they did have a membership. They just didn't really ever borrow. And that money was used in a pig butchering crypto scam. that increased the losses this bank and the FDIC would incur once it became not, you know, once the regulator realized this scam was happening. And so I think one of the things is like whether or not the FHLB is even fulfilling its mission to help with affordable housing. I do think it's interesting to think about how is the availability of the money distorting the decisions banks are making at really important moments where like maybe they should not make that decision. It's almost like too easy. And I don't know if that's the FHLB's problem or the role that the FHLB has just played in market funding that is inserted before a bank would hit the discount window, right? So like you don't even have to think about all the reasons why you wouldn't want to use the discount window and the stigma around it because you can just go to the FHLB and it's so easy.
Right. And the other thing is the FHLBs offer a whole term of loans. The discount window right now offers 90 days. It's legally restricted to 4 months. You could get a 20-year loan from the FHLBs. I mean, they are a reliable partner in your funding structure, which is sort of the other challenge is the FHLBs have a very commercial relationship with banks. They want to help, which is good to some degree. Like the Fed could use more of this, right? The Fed has sort of a culture issue internally around the discount window. You know, you hear Powell say, hey, discount window is good. Like banks should feel comfortable using it, but supervisors on the ground are saying,
tell that to the supervisors here.
Right.
Yeah, right.
Right. So the FHLBs don't suffer from that. It's a very commercial relationship. They want to help until they can't. And then it causes problems for the Fed because, like you said, like you kind of illustrated, Kia, like it's too late in the day or, you know, there's
SCBC
some relationship
Bank.
That's not built. Yeah, right. Exactly.
TrueStage Payment Guard Insurance is a first of its kind insurance solution built for digital lenders, designed to help you attract more borrowers, strengthen your loan portfolio, and reduce time spent on collections, all with minimal tech lift needed to go live. To learn more about Payment Guard Insurance, visit truestage.com/payment-guard and speak with a member of the TrueStage team.
So how much of a correlation can I draw between the FDIC's special assessment on banks, the senior lien position that the FHLB takes in a bank failure, the FDIC prepaying the FHLB's $285 million on advances taken out by banks that later failed, and then the system making almost $7 billion in revenue, up from 110% last year.
And, please explain Kia's question to fintech listeners who don't have any idea what she just said also.
I connected all the dots. I don't know how to make it easier. I walked everyone to the answer.
You really didn't.
So yeah, there's a lot there. We can sort of gloss over the super lien to some extent. The FHLBs have a statutory super lien, which basically just gives them a lot of authority to get paid back. So the FHLBs have never experienced a loss on their advances. We talked about the FHLB Seattle failure. That was about its investment portfolio, which is a whole other piece of the FHLBs, which is that they can go out and issue debt to government money market funds. You know, remember, they'll tell you we have no government guarantee. Like we have no government protection. They go to government money market funds, which can otherwise only buy treasuries, and they sell debt to them and they go buy mortgage related assets and they pocket the spread. That is like pure rent collection. And, you know, it's risky for the ultimate rescuer, which is probably going to be the Fed, the taxpayer, whatever. So the super lien is sort of an issue, except for the fact that the Fed always gets what's called perfected in its security interest. So this doesn't really affect the Fed as much. The FHLBs usually get a perfected interest as well. And the super lien kind of covers what's left over.
Okay.
So it can matter and it can make workouts complicated. It matters less than it did 20 years ago. The prepayment fee thing is that, so what we see is all these, like you listed before, all these failed banks have a ton of FHLB debt.
Yeah, they fail with a bunch of debt.
Fail with a bunch of FHLB debt, which is well secured. You know, it's going to get paid back, but a lot of times acquirers will leave it behind because it's still, you know, it's cheaper often than the Fed or about as cheap as the Fed, but it's more expensive than deposits, you know. So if you're an acquirer with a healthy franchise, you'll pay back the relatively expensive funding. Or you'll leave it with the FDIC. And the FHLBs charge prepayment fees for prepaying their advances. And it's supposedly based on the cost of their hedge and blah, blah, blah. So what Kia was referring to is it just came out that in 2023, the FDIC had to pay the FHLBs $285 of prepayment fees,
Whoa.
So the FHLBs don't even waive it, you know, that cost.
Yeah, not even as a courtesy to the FDIC.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's ridiculous.
And the FDIC paid it. Like, that's the other thing, too, is the FDIC. Like, I would have loved to see a fight there.
So the FDIC paid a prepayment fee for essentially keeping those assets that are good, but take a little while to sort of unwind based on bank failures.
So it's the FHLB loans that the failed banks took out that when the FDIC then sold the failed banks were left behind by the acquirers. So the FDIC is sitting on these loans, pays them back.
Has to pay a prepayment fee. Wow, that's crazy.
$285 million.
So like sometimes I think of the FDIC as kind of basically a big pot of money, and that money is the deposit insurance fund, I guess. So is there a connection between basically the FHLB loans and that prepayment fee and then the amount that the deposit fund dipped under and had to be funded through the special assessment? Because there was reports that the FDIC has told banks that paid the first assessment that they might actually have to pay a second assessment because the first assessment figure that they calculated was too low.
Yeah, totally. I mean, okay.
it's the same pot of money. It's coming out from the same pot.
Yeah, it comes right out of the FDIC bottom line, which then, you know, gets fed back to the banks.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was interesting because, you know, the reports I was reading, the banks were complaining about the FDIC. And I was like, you're so close to the group that you maybe should be complaining about, right? It's not, the FDIC is just this middleman trying to, they're the person in a bankruptcy just trying to adjudicate everything and make sure everyone gets paid and everything balances out. Like the FDIC didn't come up with the full, no, it's not the FDIC's loss. The FDIC just has to make sure the hole that they have fronted to cover this loss gets refilled. There are other people who are responsible for the size of this hole, right?
There's a certain bit of irony too that ultimately the amount of cost that was paid by the big banks for the FDIC to invoke the systemic risk exception and just the costs associated with First Republic, which didn't get a systemic risk exception, were much greater than if these banks had done a capital injection and saved the bank. Like, you could have gotten the six biggest banks together and had them do a capital injection that was way less expensive and probably, you know, stabilize the bank. But
do you think the banks that have to pay the special assessment to the FDIC have made it up in their dividends they receive from the FHLB?
That was going to be my question. Yeah. Like, is the money just, is it circular? Like, who, then to add a fine point to that, that was something I was going to ask is, what is the overlap on dividends and like sort of controlling interest by banks and the FHLB?
Like, start making some spreadsheets.
So the way this works is when you take out a loan from the FHLB, you leave behind a certain percent of the proceeds as a capital investment. So this is how the FHLBs are able to scale up in a way, like, you know, you can't issue $500 billion of loans in a week and not have any capital to back it if, in theory, you know, you're worried about risk of default. And so the way they scale up so fast is you leave behind, you know, 4% of the loan as capital and you're paid a dividend on that capital. So it's really only the borrowers who get paid. There's sort of a nominal dividend that goes to all members. I mean, really nominal. And the main dividends go to borrowers. And so if you're JP Morgan or something, you didn't make up your FDIC assessment
from the FHLBs,
right?
Yeah.
Right. So, but this is serious money if you're SVB or somebody else, you know, that borrowed a substantial amount. It's enough to affect your financing.
Maybe
costs.
The FDIC gets the dividend then? Or did they surrender the SVB dividend?
That's a good question. It depends when it gets paid and when it's applied, but they would have had it depends how long the advances were outstanding too, but the bridge bank would have gotten, you know, or whatever, the resolution entity would have in theory gotten something.
Well, that was my right lightning round, the world's longest lightning
round. That was long. That was really long. But no, I definitely learned a lot just from listening to you guys.
I know, Alex's eyes are bugging and
really?
He's like, wait, what?
Yeah, no. Well, I mean, like, and it kind of goes, Kia, to your point about like Heartland Tri-State just as one example. Like, there is something very strange about just in terms of the FHLBs versus the Fed. Like, one, they both are like lenders of semi-last resort that you can turn to.
Second to last. That's the joke about
that. Second to last versus last. But like, I think part of the dynamic that maybe drives that is like, especially if you're the CEO of Heartland Tri-State and you're doing bad things, like, I don't really want to go to the cops to ask for a loan. You know what I mean? Like, the Fed is your regulator and also your lender of last resort. the FHLBs are like, no, it's cool. Like, you know, just borrow money. Like, so there is sort of an interesting dynamic between those two. And I think sort of understanding the ripple effects of that is just fascinating.
Right. It's a hard question now, too, because so much of the conversation around the discount window is like, we need to make it more friendly, make it more, if you have the collateral, you get the loan, no questions asked. But this is also kind of the problem with the FHLBs, right? Is that
they just care
if they get paid back and they're not calling up the Fed to narc on you, you know.
That
you,
I will say the one thing that's great about the FHLB and the reason why I was thinking about AOCI probably like a little bit sooner than other people is that the FHLB will not allow you to borrow if you have negative tangible common equity. And so they're actually like the discipline around unrealized losses in the AFS portfolio, which is why, you know, even though if you added SVBs, held to maturity, unrealized losses, they had negative tangible common equity, but they were allowed to borrow from the FHLB because it was AFS was fine. But anyways, so there are banks that can't borrow, the 30 banks that can't borrow from the FHLB because they have negative TCE,
right.
But they have to get a waiver from their regulator, whatever. Anyways, that's the one thing that I think is good is that they use the better capital metric.
Yeah, and I should have been more clear before when I was talking about the dozens of banks with negative mark-to-market equity. I was saying TCE. I really meant including the held to maturity.
Oh, you're doing right. HTM. Okay, I was just doing HTM.
Yeah, and you're right. The FHLBs don't include HTM, so you can still kind of hide the losses there and get an FHLB loan. But yeah, they care about AOCI.
All right. Okay, so I'm going to gavel off this particular branch of nerd talk, although we could keep going on it for a while, obviously. Stephen, my lightning round question for you, and I'll go so much faster than Kia. I'm going to show Kia how we actually do
actually
lightning
rounds. What that means.
All right, here we go. So I wanted to ask you about private credit, because I know you've sort of commented a little bit on this space as well. And just for a little bit of background for listeners, private credit, which is just loans made to private companies by non-banks, is a market that has grown to about $1.7 trillion, up from about $300 billion in 2010. Most of private credit, if you look at it in terms of a pie and how you divide up the different segments, most of it is private loans to corporations where companies are just borrowing large sums of money. However, there is a growing segment within the private credit bubble called asset-based finance. And asset-based finance is really just loans made where there's an asset attached at a more granular level. And that could be financing and the asset is airplane engines or fiber optic cables, or from a financial services context, loan receivables. So you can get a loan if you are a firm and you're making point of sale loans to consumers, you can essentially securitize those receivables and sell them as assets and get a loan back to fund that lending. So an increasing amount of non-bank lending is being funded by private credit. I think Atalaya Capital Management said that it could get to about $900 billion in the next few years, up from about $350 billion where it currently is. And the reason, Stephen, I wanted to ask you about this is that just from like not necessarily financial stability, but just the composition of the financial industry and sort of where we draw the lines between banks and shadow banking and that whole sort of discussion, this one strikes me as a really interesting growth area because private credit is exploding. It has continued to grow somewhat irregardless of kind of macroeconomic factors. So I would have thought that it would have been a more sort of popular asset class for private equity and for other investors when rates were really low, but then rates went up and private credit still kind of kept chugging along. This is really eating into a lot of the lending that banks used to do. And I think you can trace a lot of the growth of private credit back to the capital restrictions that came about after 2010. But what's your sort of just high-level read on private credit, where we're going, and what people should be paying attention to in this space?
My high-level read follows what you said. Part of this is a movement of capital risk outside the banking system, which has regulatory capital constraints that exceed, you know, what a private capital firm, you know, faces, which is nothing.
They can take as much risk as they want, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Until the market doesn't let them. So I'll say a couple things. So, I mean, one part of the story for why this boomed even with high rates is the banks themselves were sort of saddled with a bunch of, you know, loans that they normally would have syndicated. It sort of crowded their balance sheet a little bit. And so that actually gave private credit a little breathing room. And there's this point, you know, when the last couple of years have been a story about interest rate risk, but there's a point when interest rate risk becomes credit risk, right? When it becomes too tight, you know, the financing is so tight that it becomes a credit story. And to the extent that's where we are, you know, it sort of makes sense for banks to step back and allow these, you know, less capital constrained firms to do that financing. I'll say two things about what to watch. One is, you know, you can listen to people talk about how, oh, this is great. It's banks without deposits. Like, this is way more stable. There's a limit to that, right? The whole point of deposits is that we demand deposits. Like, that was an unintentional use of demand deposits.
I was
going to
say, that was a good one. Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard of demand deposits. Yeah, go on.
Right. There is like a certain amount of demand for those kinds of liabilities. And that's the special thing that banks do. There's not an infinite amount of demand for locked up private capital, you know, that funds these long-term loans, which is how this works. You know, it's wealthy customers. So that's one, that's a limit to how big this thing can be. Two, what we see a lot of recently is banks financing private credit funds.
Right.
So banks are basically taking a step back. So, you know, you can see that story unfolding already of private credit funds sort of, you know, need capital, don't have ready access to more funding. They can get it from the banks. And so what we're seeing, I've been calling this a retranching, like banks are moving more senior in the capital stack. They're lending to the private credit funds, which are then taking the capital risk. And if you're a bank, you know, it's less demands on your capital to lend to Blackstone than to do the loan that Blackstone is doing to, you know, a bunch of RV financing or whatever.
Right.
And the story I always share here is that, well, there's a couple instances of this now, which is that we see banks selling portfolios to private credit funds. They're unloading, you know, asset risk, basically. People have called it a risk-weighted asset diet. Like, they're trying to get rid of some of their RWAs, and they're providing financing for the deal. So they're like, they have the senior financing. They're funding the buyer to buy the risk from them. And that's exactly the illustration. It's like, you're moving the capital risk, but you're still the bank as funds. So I'm watching how much these private credit funds are getting leveraged, because at a certain point, then they're just a leverage risk. But right now, you know, they're just a nice competitor. They're doing loans, like, they're pretty stable.
Wait, Stephen, I have a question. And Alex, you didn't mention regulators being extremely concerned about this space.
They've started to bring it up. Yeah, it's something that's popping on the radar, it seems.
Yeah, I just read that Brookings paper with a former Fed Governor Tarullo, where he talks both in the same breath about how big the big banks are and then how big the non-bank space is. And it's like, buddy, like, I don't know what to tell you, but, you know,
the money,
like,
has to go somewhere. Yeah.
Right, but also, like, if you're concerned, it feels like if we have a big economy, we kind of have to have both, or we, you know, you can't have a small non-bank space and then not big banks. It just, to me, it feels inevitable that a big economy necessitates large financing vehicles. And the question is, do you want that in the regulated financial industry space or in a different, under a different regulatory regime? I feel like the size is almost not the point, right? Because you set up the rules and then everyone responded to the rules. And it feels like you can't, like, don't hate the player, hate the game, you know?
Yeah, well, the other thing, just to add to that just a little bit, Stephen, and then please respond to what Key just asked, because I think that's a great question, is there is also this element of, for all these funds that are kind of getting involved in private credit, where can we source capital to put more money into this, to your point? And obviously some of that's coming from banks. Apparently private equity is getting much more involved in insurance and annuities and using those sort of long-term liabilities to fund a lot of this as well. And so I'm also looking at, like, where are all of these, like, lines of capital spreading out? They go to, like, sovereign wealth funds in other countries. And so, like, yeah, like, how big should that non-bank lending space be, given that regulators have kind of clamped down on banks?
Yeah, it's a good question. And to the extent private credit is incorporating insurance firms, like, they're getting closer to the regulatory perimeter. And insurance firms, you know, have pretty onerous regulations.
Yeah.
So it's sort of coming. And, you know, we see bank regulators talk about this through, like, oh, we're going to look at banks, you know, prime brokerage. We're going to look at banks funding exactly what they're doing, which is sort of moving up in the capital stack.
Yeah, like leverage lending and things like that.
Right. But the banks are the ultimate source of funds in the economy. I mean, it's like I was saying before, that the a deposit is sort of the most fundamental demand of a financial system. It's our most basic need. And so that funding can always be there in a way that the riskier finance can't. So there's always a trail back to the banks. And regulators have started to talk about it this way, like, oh, we can see some of this stuff through our supervision of the banks, which, you know, is an okay way to go about it. But I mean, to Kia's point, like, the risk is going to show up somewhere. The question is, you know, is it systemically risky or not? And do you have, you know, do you have to worry about it, go after it?
Right. Absolutely. Kia, that is how a lightning round question is done. That
I'll take notes for next time.
Just like it's some notes for you. Okay, Stephen, that was awesome. Before we let you go, a thing we always do on this podcast is let Kia rant about something at the very end. And then I try to reel her back in or just sort of join her out on the edge. Normally it's a bank related topic, but Kia, you had an insane take that I think you shared a while ago on Twitter that you then resurfaced. And I would like you to share that take, and then Stephen, you and I can just respond if she convinces us or not. So Kia, please.
Well, this is so interesting because I think this is probably the most correct and rational take one could have towards potatoes, which is that I think potatoes are mostly, they're definitely overrated. Like, all potatoes are overrated, but most of them are bad. And I did not realize that, like, this opinion formed when I realized that there were people who were starting to align their personality traits with potatoes and their enjoyment of potatoes and their defense of potatoes. And I was like, well, that's, potatoes are so mid, right? Potatoes are, I think, a fundamentally difficult ingredient to cook with because not only do they have no flavor and almost no nutritional value, they have a lot of water, which makes them really, really hard to cook. And I think other people who say they like potatoes actually like butter and fat and salt and crunchiness.
Yeah.
And I would argue that potatoes contain none of those ingredients. And so when you say you like a baked potato or you like whatever, like, I can't even think of a good potato. I can't even think of an
potatoes,
example of a good potato.
Baked potatoes, French fries, chips. I could name like great potatoes
French fries
all
are
day.
Like so almost divorced from the structural like integrity of a potato. In order to make a good French fry, you have to soak those things for like hours.
Yes.
And you have to double fry them.
Yes.
In what universe do I need to cook something twice in order to make it delicious?
Okay,
right?
All right, this is insane. Okay, all
right.
So I'm going to just gavel you off there because that's, I can't. So, all right. So just like, and Stephen.
I did talk faster and louder.
That was good. It was a very passionate rant. So, all right, here's the thing. You seem to be judging potatoes entirely based on their nutritional value, which is utterly irrelevant.
No, on their flavor. They're disgusting. They're boring. They got bad texture.
But they
and
get
they
transformed
have no,
into
they have...
the greatest things ever. Like, here's the thing about potatoes is they are a vehicle to
once
create,
you take all
like,
the water out of them, they can do almost anything.
Yeah, which is fine. And, like, to your point about the cooking thing, that's fine. I've tried to cook French fries at home. It was really a pain in the ass. It
I'm
was
correct.
Not worth it.
I am 100% correct.
No. But, like, the thing is, like, we now live in a modern economy where I can outsource that work to other people. Like, I don't want to cook French fries myself, but I damn well want to eat them. They're like the most delicious things ever.
You're just not really eating a potato anymore.
Stephen, please jump in.
You're eating potatoes that don't resemble a potato anymore, that have been reconstituted, frozen, and then fried.
No, Stephen, go.
Do you eat bread?
Yeah, I love bread.
How often do you eat plain bread with nothing on it?
So I griddle. My normal perfect breakfast is a piece of griddled bread.
Okay, so how often do you make bread from scratch?
Zero.
And that is a totally onerous process to make bread from scratch.
Yeah.
And bread is rarely eaten plain.
Okay, but Steven, I think you're missing the point.
The actual question you should be asking is not about bread.
I'm Asian. You should be asking about rice.
All right. Same question. Well, that's a little easier to eat plain, but same question.
Because plain rice to an Asian person is the most perfect form, the highest form, right? And then it only gets better when you add more ingredients to it. But plain rice is great on its own.
Well, that is an interesting point, right? Because, like, in my head, I have these different categories
of things.
Yeah, you
would not,
in
any universe, are eating a plain cooked potato, right?
I don't. I mean, the thing is, and maybe this is where I differ from you, there is no baseline food that you put other food on top of that I like plain. Like, I don't like plain bread. I don't like plain pasta. I don't like plain rice. I don't like plain potatoes.
Right.
None of those things are good at all. They
you
are
just
all
need,
vehicles.
These are all just base vehicles
for getting other things into my mouth. And, like, potatoes are by far the greatest vehicle food ever created. Like, why do you think everyone in Ireland left that country?
So much better.
Like, what? Like, there's a reason we still talk about the potato famine, like, 200 years later. Like, that was devastating to an entire country. No. Like, it is
that's what we
central.
Talk about it, so.
It is central to making everyone's lives better. Potatoes are amazing.
So I just think potatoes are boring. I think they're difficult to cook. I think they have bad texture. I think you have to add a lot of ingredients to make them taste good. I will say they are, because they're so bland and have no flavor of their own, that is interesting. They are conduits. So I will say that. But I think there's just always like a better, I eat potatoes. Like, to be clear, I eat potatoes. I think most of them are overrated. I have a hierarchy of potato orders that I will,
We don't have time to get into that. Yeah, I'm sorry. We can't go through your whole hierarchy.
I actually think most French fries are bad. So I think most French fries are not as good as the best French fries, but the delta between the best French fry and then the average French fry is very big. So I think everyone thinks of the best experience they've ever had. But I just want everyone to be very aware that what's so funny about this opinion is I can just go through life and I don't have to talk about potatoes. I bring up this opinion because other people really like potatoes. And that confuses me. I would be so embarrassed if I really, really liked potatoes and then I talked about it publicly, because I think that would reflect very poorly on the things that I'm interested in and the taste that I have. And so I would just probably keep that love quiet. But I'm doing this because other people really identify with loving potatoes as an interesting part of their personality. So that's where the opinion comes from. So next time you want to...
I would contend it's not an interesting personality trait. Precisely because everybody loves potatoes.
Well, but people love potatoes, though. Don't you? Potatoes are universally...
That's what makes this take crazy, is that potatoes are universally beloved. They're on every table meal. They're amazing.
They're just available. They're not loved. They're just
available. They are absolutely beloved. No. They're just a
really common side item. And there are other items you could have.
No. Just to give one example of that. I go to a steak restaurant and there's a really great one in Montana and they're like, okay, you get two sides with your meal. And I'm like, well, what are the sides? And they go through a bunch of different options. There's carrots, there's, salad, there's all kinds of different things. I always get, with my steak, a fully loaded baked potato and French fries. And I just double up on the potatoes.
My God,
that's how amazing potatoes are. No, it's so good. It's so good. I mean, not the healthiest choice, but that's not the point of going to a steak restaurant. It is so, so good. All right. I'm going to gavel us off there. As the host, I just get to declare that the argument is over. Steven, I don't feel like Kia convinced you. Is that fair?
That is correct.
I hope that the next time you eat them, you experience slightly less enjoyment because you do realize that this item is just, it has its limits, right? And you encounter them really quickly.
Even if you're right, Kia, let us enjoy our ignorance.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I don't want to be ashamed when I'm eating potatoes. Now I'm going to have this thing in the back of my head. So hopefully listeners won't either. That was an absolutely outstanding conversation. Steven, you see why... we tend to get off the rails, especially at the end there. But thank you for humoring us. Thank you so much for coming on and educating us on all those topics. This was an absolutely great conversation. We really appreciate it.
It was great to be here and hear from you guys.
Thanks so much, Steven.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FinTech Takes. Stay up to date with emerging companies and the latest FinTech trends by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts. And if you love FinTech Takes, please tell a friend.